The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good evening. It's nice to see you all. Well, there are so many of us here. That's okay. So I've been teaching on views. The first week I talked about views and spiritual bypassing. The second week I talked about views and conflict. And tonight I'm going to talk about views and how they're not direct experience, how they're something different than our experience. So maybe it's not, for those of you who are familiar with the Buddhist teachings, it's not surprising, as I'm probably not telling you anything you don't already know, but that the Buddha really emphasized this importance of direct experience, of really knowing and seeing things here and now, like we do with mindfulness practice. And in some of the Buddhist literature and the scriptures and the suttas, there's a story where he categorizes the types of spiritual leaders that are present at the time when he's alive. So at that time, there was a lot of different practitioners, traditions, philosophers, and he was just one of a collection. And he said, well, there are some teachers that hold their sacred texts as authoritative. When I say texts, I mean they didn't actually have, you know, books, but they was memorized and passed down from generation from one person to the next. So there's that group of practitioners which hold their scriptures as authoritative. There's another group of practitioners that have faith. They just have faith in either a particular teacher. They just believe that this teacher is awakened or is able to zap them, quote unquote, in some kind of way and let them have some awakening experience. Or maybe they had some deities that they had faith in, that they believed in. So those were some other types of practitioners that the Buddha characterized, people that they have just a faith in, a belief in. Then a third group were those practitioners who used reasoning and logic. So this way they're more like maybe contemporary philosophers. If this, then that. If not this, then not that, or something. So they had their spiritual tradition that was based more on a philosophy and in thinking and cognizing and reasoning and using logic. And then there was a fourth category, or maybe one, two, three, four, yes, fourth category, who this tradition that based their experiences as being authoritative, as what they had actually known, what they'd actually seen for themselves as being kind of pointing towards the truth. And the Buddha put himself in this category. He said, you know, unlike all these other ones, all these other types of teachers and these other types of traditions, he put himself in that as based on their experience. And he said, there are some mendicants, I'm using this word mendicant, we can, all kinds of different words we could use there, practitioner, recluses, philosophers, sometimes some people use, I'm going to use this word mendicants. There are some mendicants who, having directly known the Dharma for themselves, maybe I'll say at this time in ancient India, the Dharma was a word for religious teachings. It doesn't necessarily have to be Buddhist teachings. There are some mendicants who, having directly known the Dharma for themselves, among things not heard before, claim to teach the fundamentals of the holy life after having reached the consummation and perfection of direct knowledge here and now. I am one of those mendicants. So he's really highlighting that the way that he became awakened was through having this perfection of direct knowledge here and now. It wasn't through philosophizing. It wasn't just simply having faith, and it wasn't just receiving teachings from somebody else. So to support that idea that, okay, so it's all about direct experience, elsewhere he writes, he's reported as saying, seeing into views, we could also say views, beliefs, opinions, stories, all kind of, we could use all these different words. Seeing into views, not grasping any of them, investigating, I knew and saw peace within. So finding peace is not about having the right view, having the right belief. Or if you do have a belief or a view, it's not about grasping. It's not about holding on to it and saying, this is true and everything else is wrong. Because that doesn't lead to peace. Last week I talked a little bit about how that leads to conflict, the opposite of peace. So just like how the Buddha for himself, he became awakened and found the Dharma, this path to awakening, through his direct experience, of course that's the focus of his teachings. But we could also say the opposite too, that he's not asking us to have blind faith, right? These teachings have been preserved for these thousands of years through generations of individuals. And there's no exhortation, there's no encouragement, just have this blind faith, just believe it because I said so, because it's in the scriptures, because you should, because something bad will happen if you don't. In fact, he criticized those traditions who seem to have blind faith as the basis of their tradition. And there's a story of this young Brahmin, and a Brahmin is a priest of the dominant religion at the time of the Buddha, what was to become Hinduism, isn't quite Hinduism yet at this time yet. And this young Brahmin went up to the Buddha and calls him Master Gotama, so using this kind of an address, using this way to address him, suggests he doesn't think that Master Gotama is an enlightened person or anything. He's just like, hey, dude. And he says, we have these beliefs based on our scriptures, and they've been passed down for generations, and these are true, and everything else is not true. What do you think of that? And the Buddha says, asks him, well, do you know if anybody knows these are true? Has anybody seen that these are true? Or do you just believe it because it's in your sacred literature? And the Brahmin said, no, I don't know if anybody's known it or seen it, this for themselves. And then the Buddha says, well, do you know anybody who knows somebody who knows this? No. Well, do you know that the people that created this, these traditions, these scriptures, did they claim to know? No. So then the Buddha says to them, well, isn't this kind of like blind people leading blind people? You don't know. You don't see. It's just about, have this blind faith, believing something. And then to contrast that, the Buddha talks about how the Dharma that he teaches, as opposed to being something that is just words and has been passed down, and that people kind of collectively have agreed that it's important. Instead, he writes, or I keep on using this word, writes, that's preserved in the suttas that he says, the Dharma, that is the teachings. And this is the language that's used. It's used like repeatedly as a way to describe the Dharma. The Dharma is directly visible. It's immediate. It's inviting one to come and see. It's applicable, and it's to be personally experienced by the wise. And this, of course, is in great contrast to just believing. Of course, this idea inviting one to come and see, for me, I find this quite meaningful. It's not being forced to do something that feels uncomfortable. Instead is this idea, I experience it as kind of like these if-then statements. If you're interested in exploring more, learning more, then come and try it. Do some of these experiences, some of these practices. If you're experiencing a lot of suffering and you're looking for something that might be beneficial and different, then maybe come and see. He's not saying go away and philosophize about it and talk about it and get in philosophical debates and think about it, right? Because that can be unending. Instead, there's this idea of come and see, and that it's directly visible. Something that's like tangible, that we can have some experiences that support us and that make sense. It's not just, I keep on coming back to this word, it's not just believing with some unverified thing. The teaching here is to go get some verification, go get some experiences that can support you. So it's directly visible, it's immediate, inviting one to come and see, it's applicable, and to be personally experienced. But he's not saying that it's actually easy. And he's not saying that it's always easy to see. It is, you can see it, but it's not always, you know, it takes a certain orientation, it takes a certain application in order to see the Dharma, in order to see what is this teaching, what is this experience that leads to greater and greater peace, that leads to greater freedom, that leads to less suffering. In a little bit I'll talk about some more specifics about this, about what's to see. But part of what the Buddha says when he's talking to one of these philosophers, and the philosopher is asking him, well, what are your views? And the Buddha is saying, I don't get into arguments about views. But the Buddha gives him a teaching, and the philosopher is really confused and doesn't understand. And the Buddha is pointing to the importance of direct experience. And if you're a philosopher, maybe that just doesn't quite compute. So the Buddha says to him, this Dharma is profound. It's hard to see. It's hard to understand. But it's peaceful and sublime. And it's unattainable by mere reasoning. Not something that you can think your way into. It's subtle. And is to be experienced by the wise. So this idea that it's hard to see and hard to understand, this is a big part of these practices that we do, the Eightfold Path, including a meditation, is to help us to see and to help us to understand. If it were easy to see and easy to understand, we would all be awakened by now. We wouldn't have to come to IFC on a Thursday night. And the Buddha goes on and he says to this philosopher, it's hard for you to understand it when you hold another view, when you accept another teaching, when you pursue a different training and follow a different teacher. This makes sense, right? That if you have this one particular framework of the and worldview of how things are, how you are, and how you are in the world, it's not easy to adopt and to see things that perhaps are really different. So I think what happens for many of us is we have a particular worldview, and then maybe there's something about the Dharma that resonates with us, that rings true. We have some experience in which it feels like, yes, there's something here. Maybe we don't understand it at the beginning, but there's this feeling like, yeah, there's something here. That was certainly the case for me. Maureen talks, when she gives the introduction for me, she mentions, you know, all this retreat practice I did. In the beginning, wow, these retreats were so hard. It's like physical suffering and mental suffering. But there was something there. I was like touching into something that felt meaningful. It wasn't comfortable. It wasn't easy. It wasn't clear. But it felt like, yeah, this is the direction for my life right now. This is the way that I felt like the Dharma just resonated in some way that made sense to some part of me, even though my family and my friends were like, what, you're going on retreat again? And my poor father was always asking me, what exactly are you retreating from? And what exactly are you doing? I didn't try to explain it all to him. I did say to him one time, and maybe it's similar to what the Buddha is saying here. Yeah, maybe this is in the same way that it's, you can't really have a discussion, an argument with somebody about the Pythagorean theorem, if you guys remember back to like geometry, back into, you know, in a high school or whatever that was. In particular, choose any mathematical theorem. You can't really get into a discussion with somebody about the Pythagorean theorem if they've never studied math. It just doesn't make sense. So that was often kind of my experience in the same way with these early retreats. But the Buddha is pointing to, okay, can you have some experiences? This Dharma is profound. It's hard to see. It's hard to understand. But it gets, in the beginning, when you're holding different views, when you have different world views, but then somehow, I don't know exactly how this works, we find something that supports us, that nourishes us, that makes sense for us. We have experiences that maybe aren't articulated in perfect views that are clear. We found ourselves drinking up the Dharma in some kind of way. We find ourselves going on lots of retreats. We find ourselves coming to hear a Dharma talk. So what's wrong about all holding beliefs? I gave a talk last week about often when we are like really holding on really tightly to our beliefs, it often just leads to disputes and arguments, and, you know, we're so invested in our particular views and feel threatened when people have different views. So that's one. I'm not going to talk about that more here. But our views may be erroneous, or they may be based on some incomplete or information, incomplete experiences, limited experiences. And then based on those, we have these distorted notions. We have this idea of how the world works, or what's important, or the way to happiness, the way to less suffering. Maybe isn't the most skillful. Maybe it isn't the way that can find our way forward with. And some of these erroneous views is we might think that some things are permanent. We might think some things that kind of come in the back of our minds, I'm never going to die. Those things that are important to me are always going to be here and support me. those people that I love, they're always going to be here. I have some mistaken views about what's permanent, what's not permanent. Turns out nothing's permanent. This course is a key insight. We might think that the things that we do are inconsequential. That doesn't really matter. It doesn't matter if I am thinking these hateful thoughts of my neighbor's dog all day, every day. I'm not saying we don't get irritated. I'm not saying we don't have reactions. But right, if we kind of are priming our mind, if we are inclining the mind a particular way, it has a consequence, even though we might not be aware of it at that time. But what about, you might ask, well, what about those views, those things that we don't have direct experience about? What about those things that we don't know and we can't know? That is, like, what happens after death? Or what is this world eternal? Has it been here forever and it'll be there forever? Or was there a beginning and is it going to end at a particular time? Or what about those types of things? Because we don't know them, we have to have views about them. You might ask yourself this. And so in one of the scriptures, the Buddha, he gives a survey of these 62 views that people hold. And these are like metaphysical views that are about these very things, that are about the nature of the self, the nature of the soul, quote-unquote, and the including what happens after death, and the nature of the world, whether it's eternal or not, and the nature of awakening. So he gives us whole list of views. These are all the different views that are out there, that 10 people have them. And then after this big, long list, he says, these views, these are for those who do not know and who do not see. If you don't have direct experiences, you have views that you're holding on to. And he's saying that these views do not lead to freedom. They do not, whether the answer to these questions, to these metaphysical questions, actually do not cause awakening. They're not the conditioning for awakening. They're the conditioning for more cogitation and debates and being concerned with intellectual ideas and no longer being with one's actual experience. And the experience here, this is where the Dharma is. This is where the teachings are. So he's saying not only, this is how he describes the Buddha, that they don't lead to freedom. And I kind of like this expression. So these speculative views, the ones that aren't possible to know, he describes them as a thicket of views, a wilderness of views, a contortion of views, a vacillation of views, a fetter of views. That is beset by suffering, beset by vexation, beset by despair, and beset by fever. And having these views does not lead to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to awakening. So rather than getting into some philosophical debates, he's pointing to how it's a thicket of views. You get in there, I'm thinking kind of like a bramble or something, where you get in there and there's little thorns and you get stabbed and you can't, doesn't matter which direction you go, you're going to get stabbed with some more thorns. A wilderness of views, maybe you get lost and just wandering around and not being able to find your way back to some stability or to the direct experience. And beset by suffering, vexation, and despair, because how can you know? How can you know whether the world is eternal? The world is eternal is a secret question of, am am I eternal? Otherwise, why would you care if the world is eternal? Unless you wanted to be eternal. And he's saying it doesn't lead to peace and doesn't lead to knowledge. So he doesn't offer, okay, there's these 62 views and here's actually the real view. In this sutta, he doesn't offer yet one more view. But here's what he does offer. He says, we can look at our experience and we can notice the nature of all our experiences. All our experiences have some things in common, whatever that experience might be. They arise and they pass away. They come and they go. They are not permanent. This is a key insight. It doesn't matter what the experience is, whether it's hearing the traffic outside, feeling the pressure of the chair against your body, hearing my voice. They arise and they pass away. And not only that, there's these three qualities that can be helpful to notice about our experiences. Rather than having views, what is the experience of having a view? Turn towards that and notice the quality that it arises and passes away. I'm not always holding on to this view. I'm not always considering these things. But not only to notice that it arises and passes away, but also to notice these three elements, gratification, danger, and escape. There might be some better translation choices, but gratification, to notice that, yes, some of our experiences bring pleasure. Sometimes our desires do get fulfilled. But they arise and they pass away. So even though our desires get fulfilled, it doesn't mean that the desire ends. I think all of us have this experience, of course, right? Just because you finally had enough chocolate ice cream, like, okay, give it, I don't want any more. It doesn't mean that you'll never want chocolate ice cream ever again. It just means at that moment you've had enough. So because of this, there's a certain amount of suffering with this arising and passing away. When they arise, we kind of want to hold on to it, even though things are slippery and they don't stay. And even if they are staying or having that appearing of staying, there's this little nagging little voice going, when is this going to go away? Do I deserve this? Or whatever little voice we might have when our desires are fulfilled. Like, oh, this wasn't quite as good as next time. Or, now exactly what did I do here so I can have this again? There's always this little quiet kind of maybe really subtle dissatisfaction. I'm not saying there isn't pleasure. There certainly is pleasure and there's joy. But it's not as satisfying as we want it to be. And evolutionary biologists will say, of course it's not satisfying. You know, evolution didn't put selective pressure on us to be satisfied. Instead, we always are, you know, looking for more food, of course, but there's always this urge to do more, be more in some abstract way. Makes it more likely we'll get our genes on to the next generation. So being satisfied isn't really in our biology, I would say. And the Buddha is pointing to our desires get fulfilled, but they're not as satisfying. So that's something else we can notice about our experiences, whatever our experiences might be. And then related to that is, of course, the danger of those experiences. Maybe that they often introduce a little bit of fear sometimes. Is this going to go away? Or this is going to stay forever. There's some uneasiness that often comes. Maybe some distress. So to notice both of these qualities, the how some of our desires get fulfilled, but also some of the distress that's associated with our experiences, which may be subtle. It may not be the dominant characteristic that we're seeing. And then the escape. So another factor that we can notice with our experiences, and that is the removal of this desire of wanting more or this desire of wanting less. The escape is the removal, the ending of that desire. And that might be temporarily with some meditative states. You can get where the hindrances are, you know, quiet, they've been quelled. And we have a certain sense of just well-being and ease, and the kind of the desire is pushed far away. Or with awakening, there's different types of awakening, different stages, different levels, different depths. That desire, that wish for more, the more awakening is, the weaker and weaker that desire gets. Complete desire doesn't go away until you're completely awakened, but some really important ones go much earlier in the practice. So instead of giving a view, as opposed to some metaphysical view, the Buddha is pointing to, no, you can turn towards your experience and notice whatever experience it is, it has these qualities, has these elements that arises and passes away. And then we have this expression, gratification, danger. It can be satisfying and dissatisfying. And escape. Notice if you can that there can be an ending of this. So this, of course, are insights. And insights are the way to freedom. Insights are the way to peace. The Buddhist teachings are about having some deep understanding into the way things are. Not a particular philosophy, but from a direct experience. And then earlier I was saying that it was, you know, not necessarily easy to see, like the Buddha says that it's hard to see. So that's why so many of the practices are about stilling the mind, stilling the heart, getting settled, so that we can see. So that we can see that little bit of dissatisfaction that's inside when our desires are getting fulfilled. And the Buddha himself, that he describes before his awakening, he describes his mind, before he had the insights that led to his awakening, he describes his mind as being concentrated, purified, bright, rid of imperfection and unblemished, so really focused and steady. And yet he also says it's malleable and wieldy, so it can move. Like, it's not like the mind is like stuck, but it has a real collectedness, but it still has flexibility. So he uses this word steady, and also attained to imperturbability, that is, not distracted. So he describes his own mind as having these qualities which enabled these really deep penetrating insights. Insights into different ways we can interpret exactly what's there, but we could say insight into suffering, the origin of suffering, the ending of suffering, and the way to end the suffering. We could also say insight into being dissatisfied, the conditions or that give rise to that dissatisfaction, as well as the arising and the cessation. The second noble truth, for those of you who are familiar with the noble truths, can be interpreted the origin of suffering, but also the arising of suffering. And I think all of this happens. Sometimes when our mind settles, it's only then that we notice, oh yeah, this thing that I thought that was going to make me happy is actually not making me that happy. This acquiring all this stuff. I was convinced that buying that one more thing or getting the latest that or whatever was going to somehow be satisfying when I was clicking that on the Amazon or when I was at the store getting out my credit card or whatever it might be. And then when we're at home with all this stuff, we realize, oh, yeah, I was so sure. I was convinced when I got it this was going to bring some happiness. And maybe it did. Maybe there was a fulfillment of a desire right there. But then to notice also the dissatisfaction that happens there. But sometimes we don't notice if we're just busy, 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 buying, talking, philosophizing, doing. So instead, in order to see the Dharma that's clearly visible, requires that the mind be a little bit collected and settled. So another way in which the Buddha doesn't say this, but that I'm imagining, that he's not pointing towards holding views as the way towards more freedom and more peace, is because having views is a kind of like an intellectualization that keeps us in our heads. And if you guys are anything like me, I can talk myself into and out of just about anything. It's quite something to watch myself do this. And so that's very unstable. Like, well, what is true? Yesterday I was thinking this, and I'm thinking that. Have you noticed this, right? If you need to make a difficult decision, well, yes, I'm definitely going to do this because A, B, and C. And then tomorrow, no, I'm definitely going to do this because X, Y, Z. So this intellectualization also, it can feed upon itself and think like, well, I'm sure I can solve this way. I can think my way into finding more peace and ease. And there is a certain amount that we can, but not this deep, stable peace and ease that the Buddha is pointing to. Not the kind that is nourishing, not the kind that is stable, not the kind that is onward leading, helps us support other people as well as find our own freedom. So views can be a way in which we just stay in our head and neglect our experiences, neglect developing a meditation practice, quieting the mind. The practices are to behave ethically. It's another way to kind of support having the mind kind of be quiet so that we can see what's actually happening. We can experience what's actually happening. And then, of course, for those of you who are familiar with the Buddhist teachings, you know that clinging is a source of suffering. If there's ever suffering or difficulties, you can ask yourself, well, what's being clung to? And I'll go one step further and say, clinging and having a really strong sense of self go together, almost synonyms. So that when we are feeling like there's a strong sense of me, myself and mine, that needs to be protected and needs to be bolstered or needs to be defended, that's when we're having strong views. They feed on each other. They're the same in some ways. So having strong views is clinging. Very often clinging to something that's related to our sense of self. Awakening is not a view. Peace and freedom is not a view. It's based on insight, which is based on experience. And not only that, awakening is about letting go, which is not about clinging. Views are more about clinging. And awakening is about letting go in very deeply about something about our sense of self that gets softened and gets maybe really loose and really broad as opposed to tight and constricted. So having views is going the opposite direction than turning towards freedom. So rather than views, the Buddha points again and again to the importance of direct experience for knowing and seeing for ourselves. In particular, having some insights into the nature of our experiences. They rise and they pass away. They have some elements that might be satisfying and they have some elements that might not be satisfying. We could also have some insights and that things don't happen for no reason whatsoever. There's cause and effect. There's conditions for why things happen. And maybe I'll stop there. This idea of maybe I'll, many of you may know this teaching with the second arrow. That is, you know, the Buddha saying that, you know, the first arrow is the difficulties that life brings us. And the second arrow is the one that we like, stab ourselves with our stories about what just happened, what life brings us. We could use different words. We could say that the first arrow is direct experience. And the second arrow is views. The freedom, sometimes direct experience is painful. I'm not going to say that it isn't. Sometimes it is. But the second arrow is more painful. It's more painful. And it's not the way to greater ease and well-being. So with that, I'll open it up to see if there's any questions or comments.
I guess I have this difficulty I'm finding whenever I hear the term direct experience, and because it, you know, there's a, it almost implies a reference, and so what is that reference? Our experience of what? And so is it that we're having somehow a direct experience of something, or are we having, or are we, is it the experience itself that we're experiencing directly? So I don't know, it's kind of confusing.
Oh, this is an excellent question. Thank you for asking this, because I didn't unpack this. It's kind of like this phrase that gets bounced around, right? And thank you for asking. Yeah, I think that instead of a direct experience, we could use the word sensation. So sensation, it could be a sound, bodily, you know, sensation, taste, visual. I would say we could say with, and including mental events, any in our inner life as well can be, I'll use the word sensation for this. So I would say direct experience is a sensation, something that we're sensing, including mental events.
So we could have a direct experience. Sorry, we could have a direct experience of a view.
Yes, absolutely. We could have a direct experience of a view. Yes. And I would say that if that experience would be one of, if we're holding on to that view, would be clinging. But also we can have a view in which we're very open-handed and we're relaxed about, and we need views. But we don't want to be clinging to them. It's more just to hold them more open-handedly, lightly. Yeah, thank you very much. These are great questions. Sometimes I forget to explain things.
One thing that strikes me is the way that the Buddha had us, I think, seeking increasingly subtle forms of experience rather than the keenly felt. And I think that's one of the things that's so attractive about the thicket of views, is that one becomes so passionate that it feels really energetic and good.
Oh, yeah.
And the Buddha is always saying the subtle, to try to perceive the subtle forms. And wherever there's a form of contentment, it can be refined to be even less agitating.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. That sometimes it does feel like energizing, right? To be holding on tightly to this view, and I'm right, and you guys are wrong, and I know it, and you don't know, that kind of thing. Or maybe it's not that explicit or that strong. But is there a way in which we can like get excited and energized without clinging tightly? I think that's perfectly fine, and we can feel this. We can notice, yeah, this is invigorating to be having this new idea. Sometimes I listen to podcasts and I get all excited when I hear like a new idea I never thought about before. Just the novelty of it is kind of fun. Like, oh wow, I never thought about that. How interesting! So, can we have that type of an idea? But I also agree that kind of the subtle can be significant. Even though it's really subtle, can be significant.
There are fewer pitfalls in the subtle.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. But we start where we are. And sometimes what we're experiencing is, not subtle. Yeah, thank you, Lewis. Great.
So you had said maybe to think about it as sensation,
mm-hmm.
and that sounded good at first.
Now you've been thinking about it,
but then it seemed too restricted, and I don't know. I'm just wondering: is one, one way to say it, is it just insight? Because insight can pertain to anything.
That's right.
Right? And also, it's not a view. It's not fixed. It's a fleeting experience. And anyway, I was just wondering if that might be the case or possible.
So let me see if
possibilities.
If I understand your question, can we have an experience of an insight, or are you asking, are they the same?
No, I'm saying, is this direct experience? Is it the same? Is insight a way of calling that or referring to it? Yeah,
I would think an insight is an understanding, a type of knowing and understanding in such a way that it has it affects your worldview in a big way, hmm. or it affects your mm-hmm. understanding of yourself. So it touches you in some mm-hmm. way. I would say mm-hmm. that's how an insight is. So it's not like just learning that tomatoes are on sale today. So it's not that kind, but... Mm-hmm. Whereas I would say an experience is just hearing that little humming sound.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Maybe it's a helicopter. I don't know what it is. Yeah. But, or that, I would say, is just a sensation. And then for every one of these sensations, we can notice, it's getting mm-hmm. louder, and then it's getting quieter, or whatever it's mm-hmm. doing. It's mm-hmm. So the practice is to turn towards what's actually happening right now.
In the moment.
In the moment.
So when that sound occurs, it's before you even start to assign any kind of meaning or whatnot to it.
Yeah, we assign meaning really quickly.
Yeah.
So we don't have to get down that into the nitty-gritty. You can. That requires a quiet mind. But just to notice, it arises, it passes away. It's not constant. It's always changing. And to notice the quality of the sensation, that might be more of an insight. Like, oh yeah, Diana said it was changing, but now I'm noticing that not only this is changing, well, that's changing, and this is changing, and wait, I can't find anything that isn't. Mm-hmm. And then that has like an impact on you when you realize that, and that impact would be more like an insight.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Is that helpful?
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, so thank you all, and I wish you all a wonderful evening, and may you find greater peace and ease that you experience directly, not just have an idea about them. Thank you.